I'm Jackie Vetrano from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And I'm Logan Bishop from Belmont University. You're listening to Higher Ed Social, part of the Connect EDU network.
Talk about whatever we want to talk about, which is a lot of fun. And because all of us work in higher ed, it naturally comes up in conversation. Sometimes it's the whole conversation, and sometimes we get off on like a cool tangent about somebody's personal life or their hobbies or what have you. So it always ends up being
like, I bought a Roomba today.
And it's exciting and life-changing.
I'm sure we'll talk about it.
It does, because it empties itself.
Yeah. Like, really?
So yes.
They've updated.
I don't have to touch it. I don't have to touch it for a month.
Oh my god!
Do you have a Roomba?
I have a Roomba, and it automatically goes. We have it on a schedule, and if we didn't have it, there would be dog hair everywhere. but I have to empty it every time. This is amazing. Well, now I'll have to put this on my Christmas list.
There you go.
Yes.
And it empties itself.
It also maps your rooms and everything. So you can say, go clean the kitchen. And it goes and it cleans the kitchen.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's new, too.
That is, it's pretty amazing. Yeah, this Roomba i7 is a pretty cool thing. And I'm so excited because I had a 700 series before this, and it has like 10 times the suction power. So like the 700 series has been cleaning the upstairs carpet, right? And you know, when you first get a Roomba, it's full. The bin is full all the time, and you have to usually empty it halfway through a job or whatever. But then as you go through time, it's gotten all that stuff out, and it just picks up what is laid down during the day, which is still a surprising amount. So I ran the 700 series yesterday, because it runs every day at 10 a.m. And then I ran the new one today, and it went to go empty its bin like 3 times. And I was just like, there was so much junk that the other Roomba didn't pick up. I am very happy with my new Roomba.
That's amazing.
That makes 2 i7s that I have, because I have one for downstairs and one for upstairs now. Because, yeah. Hey, it's better than paying someone to do it for you.
There's no judgment here.
And I have, how many cats do I have now? 5?
Oh my god.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you need 2 Roombas.
Well, I mean, if Roomba could go up the stairs, that would be the game changer right there.
Right.
I mean, not that emptying itself isn't a game changer in and of itself, but if they could go upstairs, yeah. But by that point, they'll probably be taking over the planet and trying to eat us or something.
But your stairs would be getting cleaned.
Yes, they would. And they need it really bad. Yeah, I have to shampoo our stairs. That's my next thing. But my back's a little busted, so I can't really do it. Because it's gonna take one person to balance the shampooer while another person cleans it, and yeah.
Do you think that they're gonna start selling kid size rug shampooers? Like they have those mini child Dyson vacuums that work?
Simon has one of those.
Simon to do it. Does it actually work? I know that the internet says it does, but
it does if you put the little pieces of dirt on hardwood floor, it works. Mm. It doesn't work so much in the carpet.
Got it.
But it looks a Dyson. Our bigger one. Hi, Sam.
Wow.
Sorry. Sam is here and she's saying hi.
Hello.
She is being a kitty.
Well, I guess now that we've gotten Logan's life update, we can probably, Jackie, I'm sure he's already started recording, because that tends to be his MO, is just jumping on the call, hitting record, and not telling anybody.
Well, so I hit record to talk about the Roomba because it's pretty awesome.
Okay. Well, then with that, Jackie, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Okay. So my name is Jackie Melhans. I am working at Northwestern University. I am a manager. So I'm the manager in the research computing team. And so basically what we do is we are liaisons to technology for researchers at Northwestern. And so that includes helping people do large scale simulations on supercomputers or doing big data analysis, cleaning ugly data sets, scraping data from the web. So you hear people collecting all this Twitter data and stuff like that. So we can do that. And then we also help people move their data. So as everybody knows, more and more data is being collected. It's getting dirt cheap to store, but at massive amounts, it's not very, very cheap, especially if you want data protection or it's HIPAA compliant. So we help people try to do that in a reasonable way that isn't too disruptive to their workflow, but helps them move data, store it, and collaborate with partners on or off campus. So that's kind of what we do. In a nutshell, I'm originally from Massachusetts, but I've lived pretty much all over the U.S. I've been living in Chicago for the past 5.5 years, and I normally enjoy it. But right now the weather's a little cold.
So I love how very casually you said that. I normally enjoy it.
The summers really make it worth it. The people really are good at, you know, enjoying the outdoors during the summer. But I do miss the mountains and I do miss the ocean. So, I was in New Mexico just before this. I miss the hiking and backpacking there. But so we fly if we want to go backpacking now.
Oh, wow. What brought you to Chicago?
The job. So my background's materials science. And so I was a scientist, a postdoc at Los Alamos National Lab.
And that's a fancy place.
Yeah, fancy and not fancy. You know, it's a government lab. So we do really cool stuff, but on a budget.
Like making nuclear weapons.
Yeah. But we stick to a budget. So, but it was really interesting. I mean, I learned a lot of cool stuff there. But, you know, I wanted to go back to a more urban environment. This job popped up and I thought that it was pretty fascinating. I knew that I didn't want to go the tenure professor route. And so I was looking for something else that I could do. And this was a really great happy medium because I could return to academia and be in that fun environment around students and learning and cool stuff happening. But now I can, you know, talk about what I'm doing and with people that I don't work with. And
Yay.
I can, yeah. And my projects change, you know, so before it was kind of like incremental changes that I was working on. And now I get to work on all kinds of cool stuff from astrophysics to material science to genomics projects. So
that's fun.
It's pretty cool.
So is Lake Michigan sort of like an ocean? I mean, it is a sort of a sea.
Yeah.
If you think of inland seas as seas.
It is sea-like. There are beaches, which honestly, I didn't know that about Chicago before I came here. Actually, I visited about a couple years before I moved here, and that was the first time I was at Chicago. I came to Chicago, and I didn't realize that there were beaches. So that's pretty exciting. I just miss the seafood. So being from New England, it's kind of like, you know, that's what you associate with your summers. Mm-hmm. And so we used to go to seafood shacks and stuff. So I do miss that, but there are great restaurants in Chicago. So I have it pretty good.
That is a good point. Wow. There is no seafood.
Yeah, I wouldn't trust seafood from Chicago, I don't think. Pizza, yes.
Yeah, the pizza's great. But there are really great restaurants that you can get good seafood. So kind of like Las Vegas, right? It's like in the desert, but they have great food.
So how cold was it? Like, did you throw boiling water in the air? Did you like do weird stuff with ice that, I don't know, probably existed all over every single flat surface? Like,
so, yeah.
Or did you just stay inside forever? Because that's what I would have done.
So we have a dog, and we don't have a yard because we live in a condo in the city. And my husband was kind enough to take the dog out every time. I did not go outside during the polar vortex, but he was wearing ski goggles because your eyes will water, and then your tears will freeze. And
oh my God.
He was wearing ski goggles, completely covered from head to toe. Even our dog was wearing something to cover his ears. So,
where did you find? I'm hearing dog earmuffs. Is that what I'm hearing?
No,
dog
headband? A neck gaiter.
Yes.
So we used a human. Our dog is 110 pounds. And so, we just put one of those over his ears.
I don't know why I immediately went to like very small dog in this situation. I literally know nothing about your dog, but I went maybe because I just watched a movie that had a small white dog in it. So that was what I was picturing in my head for some reason. But I guess that makes a little bit more sense. Yeah. But like, it's so scary because like a dog can't tell you like, hey, my paws are frozen.
Yeah.
Like, please do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, he had boots and he has a coat too. But yeah, even you could tell his paws were getting cold because he was trying to lift them off the ground. So yeah, it was a bummer. But we survived.
Oh man, I didn't think I thought dogs hated those boot things. Like that's why they walk all funny.
Yeah, once they're outside though, usually they're pretty good about it and they forget they're wearing them.
I have an indoor cat. This is not a problem. I don't think she would ever let me put boots on her.
Nope. If you want to die, that's a great way to do it.
Yeah, she would not appreciate that. I was considering getting her a small harness, though, because that's a thing. Because as much as cats can, like, go outside and walk around, I don't think she's smart enough to come back. So we'll have to keep her close. Keep her very close. So did you guys have off of school then for a while? Like, were classes canceled?
We did,
or did you have, like, an uproar of students, like, why do I have to walk to class today?
No, classes were canceled. Campus closed, I think, 8 p.m. on the Tuesday night. It was closed Wednesday, and then Thursday at noon it opened.
Wow.
But a lot of people just worked from home even Thursday because it was just so cold.
Mm-hmm. It's just like there's a point where there's nothing you can do about it. Like you just have to stay inside because there's nowhere to go. I can't believe your eyes water. I didn't realize that.
Aren't you from Buffalo? Like, haven't you had weather like this before?
Not like I have to wear goggles on my face because my tears will freeze situation. Never in my life. So, Jackie, you mentioned that you've been all over the United States. Where was your favorite place to live? Or is your favorite place to live? Doesn't sound like it's Chicago, but I'll let it be a part of the mix.
That's a good question. So I haven't lived in New England since I was 18, but I still think that that's my favorite place in the U.S.
That's
just because it has mountains, ocean.
Are they really mountains, though?
Yeah.
I mean, they're old mountains, but
they're really,
I mean,
really, really old mountains, yes.
They're really old. And so, you know, I'm not like a crazy skier. I will get on the mountain. So I don't need... But I mean, the snow isn't as good as as Utah. But
it's kind of ice in Utah. Well, it's kind of ice on the East Coast in the Appalachians because they have to make it and then it freezes solid. In Utah, they get real snow because it snows every day. Maybe not every day.
Makes more sense.
But yeah, I mean, so I lived in Pittsburgh. I lived in Atlanta, and then New Mexico.
What's your least favorite place to live?
So I loved Atlanta. It was such a fun city, but the thing that got me out of grad school and helped me graduate was the summers. I just couldn't do it. It was too hot for me.
I don't know anybody that loves Atlanta.
It sounds like it's booming. Like it's really
is.
Like
That's
people
why everyone
are.
Everyone hates it.
Oh, the people that are from there?
Well, no, in general, I mean, Atlanta has the absolute worst traffic because they never built the infrastructure to handle the growth that they have. So it's just so sprawling. And unlike places like, New York or Chicago, I won't say LA because LA kind of is just as bad, but... it just doesn't feel like it's not easy to get around. And the culture of Atlanta is not to actually use public transportation. Everybody has to have their own car, which is why 2 inches of snow closed school early. The whole city shuts down. Because everybody gets stuck in traffic for 8 hours getting home because they all left at the same time. Like, it's horrible. Atlanta just, it's really rough.
It's definitely somewhere I would like to visit, though. I feel like it seems like a cool vacation spot.
It's definitely worth visiting. The summers, it's just really hot and humid.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Buffalo, as Logan mentioned, and I'm now living in North Carolina, and this is the first time I've ever experienced humidity so many days, aka months, in a row. And I can only imagine what it was like in Atlanta, because I'm not even that far south in comparison. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's pretty uncomfortable, would be the word.
At least so where you're at. You have the mountains to the west of you, so a lot of moisture is kind of dumped out of that as it crosses over. So it is a little drier there than it is down in Atlanta, where it is sweltering. I used to live north of there in Calhoun. I just, not a fan. Yeah. We would go to Chattanooga instead of Atlanta to go shopping, even though Atlanta was a little closer. So...
Yeah. So I guess we can transition over into work life, because I love data and all things data. And I was very excited to have you on the podcast because I love data things. So I'm curious the types of things that you're working on, because this is a role that I have never actually heard of before, mostly because I've never worked at like a very large research university before, let alone like with folks that manage data and help people do data and tech. So I'm curious, like, what you're working on and the types of projects you help out with.
Yeah, so I can give you a few examples. In terms of engineering is kind of where we started supporting, and so they do large scale simulations. That's my background. So I was doing large scale simulations at Los Alamos, and so basically, you can create a bunch of data by simulating how atoms might move. So one of the examples I like to give is if you're thinking about maybe a material that's on an airplane, you definitely don't want it to fracture very quickly. You want it to fracture over a long period of time, because then somebody can catch the crack, right? Mm-hmm. Before something terrible happens. So instead of having to build a material every time, you can simulate it and then, you know, kind of see how it might act, and then you can actually build the material and verify what your simulation said. So that's one of the things that we do. So we help people generate this data, and then they have to manage it, and we help them figure out, you know, how do you store it? You know, what can you get rid of? What really isn't important to your research, and what really should you be including in your papers and things like that? Another example is genomics data. So we help people take a bunch of genomic data, so people's DNA or RNA sequencing data, and figure out, you know, what are, you know, these key pieces in the DNA that make you more predisposed to a certain type of cancer or a disease. That's some of the cool things that we're doing. So helping people sort through that data, align it, and kind of find those patterns. Another thing is we help people scrape data from the web. So one example is government databases. One project that we worked on was trying to look at prison data in different states. And so each state has their own database they were taking. And so we were getting prisoner data out of each state's database. I would think it was like a handful, like 5 states. And then we had to clean it because, you know, each state government has a different type of database. And so you can't really mash all that data together and analyze it. You have to kind of line it up and make sure that, you know, you're having the same categories and all those different things. But you have to kind of program, you have to have a smart program that you write that just basically looks and grabs the data that you want. And so this is pretty common, and this is how people, you know, generate these huge data sets that, you know, you can just, the internet is just a huge, like an amazing resource for people mm-hmm. to mine and do whatever research they could imagine. So those are some examples.
That's any so questions many different. Totally with you. Got it all. That's just so many different projects that are like across the board.
Yeah. So that's what makes the job really fun.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I'm very lucky.
Yeah. What departments now are you supporting?
All of them? Yeah. So we support a ton of departments. So Northwestern, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's not really it's not an engineering school. It's not a social sciences school. It's kind of an everything school. And so that was new to me because I went to predominantly engineering schools. And then, you know, I was working with physicists and engineers. And so I came here and I was like, oh, okay, now I'm working with you know, doctors, medical doctors, and social scientists, and humanists. And so we support astrophysics, material science, chemistry, physics. Let's see here. We support psychology. We've supported political science, history, English, genomics. One new project that's come on is looking at how diseases spread. And so it's not like about the disease necessarily, but more so how it spreads and, you know, what that looks like.
Right.
So it's pretty cool.
So are you guys writing the simulation yourselves or for the professor?
It depends. So the engineering stuff, it's pretty, pretty traditionally used. So it's been, you know, it's been in the field for decades. And then we sometimes help people write homegrown software. So they might be doing something completely different, or they're writing their own package for a software. And so we can help do that, especially if it's not running properly on a supercomputer. We definitely write our own code when we're scraping data and cleaning it. And then for the genomics stuff, there's actually a pretty great open source community who is developing these genomics tools. And so people, you know, in the field are playing with these tools, and there's a bunch of talented bioinformaticians around the world who are developing these tools. And for that stuff, we mostly help make it run on the cluster or make sure that, you know, the tools that they're using are appropriate.
That's so cool. How much then do you feel like you have to know about these different subjects? Because I feel like even if you're, data is data, sure, but if you don't know anything about like this, like DNA data that you're receiving, like that's pretty challenging.
So I think that if you have a basic level of science, the researchers are really good at explaining to you what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Really it's their job to be able to communicate what they're doing, because otherwise there would be no impact on their research, you know, in the research that they're doing, if they didn't share it with the world. And so they're very good at explaining to us what's going on. Yeah. And it's our job to be able to speak that language to our partners in IT, like our system engineers, telling them kind of, you know, what are the things that we're making an impact on, and also why are we configuring, you know, our supercomputer a certain way? So, and most of our team, we have research backgrounds. And so we might be a little bit unique when it comes to IT in that way. I think that definitely helps understand the culture that the researchers might be experiencing. I think that we're really lucky that we have
great faculty and students to work with that help us understand these things.
That's so fun. I'm like really jealous of your job. That's so cool.
Yeah, and I mean, the team is definitely a hodgepodge of people. We all have different backgrounds. So like I said, I'm material science. We have somebody who has bioinformatics in their background. So she obviously supports the genomics research. One of our lead data scientists, she's from political science. And we have somebody who actually was pursuing a career in ballet to begin with. And so, yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing, the spectrum of folks that we have. I think that the diversity in our team definitely makes us stronger because we can relate to the different cultures on campus because, you know, research culture in social sciences isn't the same as engineering. And so engineering, you have a team of grad students usually. And so you have a great support system. And I didn't realize that in English, for example, oftentimes a grad student might be working with a faculty or might not be and might be completely on their own. And so we're a great resource because we can help walk that student through what, you know, they might need to do. So I didn't realize, you know, what our value could really be in the social sciences because I didn't understand the culture. But once the person with the political science background joined the team, she was able to explain that to me. And so it just makes us better.
That is so cool. I'm just very jealous. So what type of projects are you working on right now?
So like I said, we have that project coming on about the spread of diseases. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited about that because I haven't worked on a project like that before. There are always new genomics researchers coming on board. And so Northwestern is definitely growing in that area. So that's it's an exciting time to be at Northwestern for that reason. Let's see here. I don't know if you're familiar with the gravitational waves discovery.
Yes.
That is so we work with some of those researchers. And so that's always exciting to hear about the new things that they're doing or the new observations that they're making. So we're constantly supporting them. And so it's not always the new people what I should say is even our old friends are making amazing discoveries. And so it's really fun to do.
That's so great. So do you have a large team? Like, it sounds like, I mean, with all these different departments that you're supporting, that there's a lot going on.
So our team is only about 10 people. Wow. And so we try to do the best that we can to support the university. And so part of one way that we do that is we provide workshops. So it's like 1 to 3 hour workshops where we teach students and faculty either computing skills or programming skills or, you know, how do you clean data sets? How do you deal with big data? Just so that they can be more effective in their own research. And I mean, really, it's, you know, it's more effective for us to teach them how to do it because then they can go on in their careers and do it rather than us doing everything for them. Mm-hmm. And really, they do most of the work. We're just really there to help support them when they're having a tough time or helping somebody, you know, onboard to something new. And then, you know, we've done our job if they are self-sufficient.
Right. Because you're not like really responsible for much of the actual analysis. It's more like the cleaning and that kind of stuff. Seemingly mundane, but I think is kind of cool.
Getting it ready for analysis. We'll help guide people if they want it. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely, there's a line where it's like, okay, that's your research and I definitely don't want to step on your toes.
Yeah.
And this is what we'd recommend, but they're the experts in their field. Right. So they really know what they're doing.
Yeah. I feel like I would just get a little nosy and start playing with it and drawing some conclusions of my own and being like, well, this is the cool stuff that I found that you probably already knew without even running this sort of research, but here's what I found.
That definitely happened. Especially when we're, so sometimes we'll do data visualizations and that's really awesome because oftentimes the researcher hasn't even seen their data visualized. And so it helps them understand what's happening. Like, for example, we have somebody working on showing a galaxy. And so, you know, you only can observe so much of space, right? And so one way that you can actually understand how galaxies work is kind of say, like, okay, I have this much data about what galaxies kind of look like. I'm going to simulate and build one. So you build this simulated galaxy, and then you can analyze stuff within that galaxy that you've built. But what you need to do is visualize it, because you can't really understand, like, okay, maybe, like, you can think of a 3D grid and say, like, okay, at point, like, A, B, C, there's a gas. And then at point, like, F, G, K, there's a black hole. But, you know, what does that really mean to your brain until you actually see it? And so, you know, you can visualize that. And it's really awesome, because you're, like, flying through this galaxy as you kind of scroll in and out. And then, you know, the researcher can say, like, oh, my God, there's a black hole here, and I had no idea. And so that happened actually last year, where somebody didn't know that there was a black hole in their simulation until somebody on our team had visualized it.
Is this the Firefly?
Yeah.
Visualization. Okay. Cool. Sorry, I was just Googling that, and
yeah,
that's what popped up, and I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool stuff to be kind of a part of that.
Yeah, that's so neat. Data visualization is a true skill that I have learned very quickly. I don't think I have, and I would like to learn. So I envy your team that can, first of all, just whip up a galaxy real fast. That's cool.
Well, it's not real fast, but I can do it. I mean, it's like, it's pretty impressive.
It's on GitHub.
Yeah, it is.
Really?
You can check it out. Yeah,
you can download it onto your computer, and
we'll be doing that as we talk.
Yeah, we have a GitHub account, and so we definitely are, you know, part of that culture of sharing, because that's what makes research effective. And so
that's super important. I mean, like, you don't want to reinvent that wheel. Just
exactly. We share all of our training materials too, and so if people want to grab those, feel free. I ask that you credit the team members that made them, but, you know, because they did put a lot of hard work into it. But
we'll definitely link the website on the show notes.
Yeah, great. Yeah, totally, and some attribution on there to remind folks to do that too. That's super nice. Yeah, it's funny, because I feel like people joke that higher ed is such a like an open and sharing type of situation, where other industries folks aren't so willing to kind of give away their secrets. But I feel like researchers are the same way. Like, it doesn't benefit anybody to keep everything, you know, closed off. And
that's right. Yourself. Right.
So, absolutely. Wow. Super fun. Well, you win for coolest job of the three of us. Congratulations. I feel like Logan and I hardly win compared to most of our guests. They're all pretty cool. So
yeah, we do our best.
I did my research, and your jobs seem pretty amazing as well. So pretty important. I mean,
we're not modeling galaxies or anything.
That is true. I mean, like, I truly cannot say I've modeled a galaxy, except like in fifth grade when you had to make that diorama of space. I did do that, which I guess is the same thing, different. Perhaps
not quite.
Am I qualified, Jackie? This is my application. I made a diorama of space when I was like 10.
Hey, if you have the passion for it, you can learn it.
Absolutely. Yeah, what got you interested in this field? Like, how did you end up here?
So in my grad student days at Georgia Tech, I quickly realized that I was better at coding than actually doing experiments in the lab. The lab equipment tended to break when I was using it. All right, things just didn't go right. I felt like I didn't adjust the ovens well. I just really messed up all of my experiments. And so I figured that the theoretical path was a better path for me. And really, I liked math. I'm a huge math geek. And I like coding. And so I decided to start doing, I pursued like simulated materials. And so I worked on materials for solid oxide fuel cells. So these are hydrogen, stationary hydrogen batteries that I was working on for my thesis. And yeah, it was, I mean, I loved it because it was a little bit more predictable. I was able to, so long as I could get the code running, I knew what I was doing. I didn't have to depend on lab equipment, which, you know, I didn't play nice with me. and then I went to Los Alamos, and I got exposed to other computational methods. And then, you know, I was looking for a job after that and trying to look to go back to somewhere a little bit more urban. And yeah, I came across this job at Northwestern, and I came on actually as somebody who just helps people get on our supercomputer. And then I kind of worked my way up to this manager position and built out the team to include things like data science and data visualization and data workflow and cloud computing and things like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's kind of how I got here.
Wow. Because I feel like it's not really like a what do you want to be when you grow up scenario. Right?
No, I don't think this job existed. You know, it's funny. I think that most jobs now when kids, you know, the kids today, their job doesn't yet exist.
Absolutely.
That they're going to have. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, how do you prepare for that, I wonder?
Right. Yeah. We had we had to fill out a small like get to know you survey at work for like an icebreaker situation. And one of the questions was, what do you want to be when you grow up? And so many people wrote like teacher or like police officer, like these very like big, broad, like still exist jobs. Yes. But I was thinking mm-hmm. the same thing of like, for many of us, like this was never a thing you would think about. Like,
yes.
I mean, I don't know how many people that I work with were like, I want to grow up and be a media relations person for a college. I don't really know, but like,
yeah,
you find your passion so late in your life compared to like when you're pressured to figure it out at like right. age 5, 6, 7.
Like, well, I mean, social media didn't exist when mm-hmm. we were, you know, in first grade, I'm guessing. Absolutely. And it's like, I don't know how old you guys are, but it certainly didn't exist when I was there. And
no.
it didn't exist when I was there.
And I mean, and podcasts, you know, that's mm-hmm. still relatively new. So,
yeah.
Oddly enough, though, it did exist.
Podcasting?
Early 2000s, it did.
Interesting. I guess they just didn't take off.
Yeah, early 2000s.
They didn't really take off until smartphones made it more of a thing you can just get. But before, you'd put them on your iPod. Hence where podcast comes from. But you would load them onto your iPod and listen to them. But there's a lot more work that goes into syncing your iPod than does just picking up your phone and saying, I want to listen to this show, and then listening to it.
yes, we've come a long way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
iPod.
Well, I think that's all the time we have for the show.
I was going to say, it sounds like a really good spot. It went so fast. I learned so much about data. This is so cool. Well, we will definitely link to all this cool stuff in the show notes because that's some really interesting stuff that you got going on.
Yeah, and if people are curious to hear more, I'm happy to have a conversation, especially if they're trying to start up a research computing operation at their university or college. So
definitely.
Thanks to both of you. I really enjoyed this. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
well,
thank you,
Jackie. Listeners, thanks for listening in. Head down to higher-ed.social and get links to stuff we talked about today, as Jackie said. You can also subscribe to the show anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you like the show, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps people find us, and it lets us know what you think of the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at HES Podcast. Send us a tweet. We love hearing from you. We love responding to you, and let us know if you want to be on the show. A big thanks to Emma Haas and Mariah Barksdale for their help making this show happen. Higher Ed Social is part of the Connect EDU network, the first podcast network for higher ed. Visit the website connectedu.network and subscribe to some awesome shows no matter where you work on campus. Thanks, and have a great week.